The cameras are rolling. Good evening and welcome to all the shareholders of GM. No, I'm just kidding. Welcome to tonight's City Council meeting. The meeting is called to order. I kindly ask that our clerk please take the roll call.
Chuck Brown.
Here.
Ralph Dantino.
Here.
Dorothy Flanagan.
Here.
Sam Hill.
Here.
Craig Maladra.
Here.
Richard Marks.
Here.
Ray Pollock.
Here.
Robert Piper.
Here.
Ron Singer.
Here.
Don Vogelsberg.
Here.
Tonight, I would like to invite none other than our chief of the fire department to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. And you might ask me why I'm doing this. Mr. Maladra, let me answer that question for you. Not only is the chief a distinguished public servant who has served the citizens of Geneva with, dare I say, gusto, but this June 4th, dear old Steve Ellison, or as we affectionately know him as Chief, will celebrate 30 years with the city of Geneva.
Ooh. Wow.
Very exciting. So after 30 years, because budgets are tight, we have nothing to give you, but if you would lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, thanks.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Chief. I noticed Mr. Piper had a tear in his eye as I was describing your terms of service.
Very moving.
With a bad haircut, one of the two. I'm not sure which one it was.
Mine or yours.
Okay, motion of censure. Item 4, folks. No, excuse me, item 3A. This is a new program that all of you received an email from Mary McKittrick about a week ago. It's new and it's not new. I think the French have a saying that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Well, years ago, we used to have presentations by our department heads on a regular basis. This time around, we have presentations from our department heads, not necessarily about, you know, the particulars of the department per se, but really kind of a 30,000-foot perspective about what the department's achieving, some of their goals, what's happening that we find interesting so that we could share with our constituents as well. And leading this charge is none other than our 30-year veteran, the Honorable Chief Steve Ellison. As is customary, we were going to invite the chief to share his presentation with us, and most importantly, with those watching at home. Because, yes, chief, there are people who watch at home.
Really?
Yes, there are. I'm certain Beth is watching right now saying, I told you not to say that. So after, we will provide any comments and or questions following your presentation. So.
All right. Thank you, Mayor. As all of you know, we're an accredited agency. And to become accredited, there are several things that you have to go through, documents that you develop to demonstrate that you can be an accredited agency. So I want to talk a little bit about the accreditation very briefly, but more in particular talk about what we call our standard of cover risk analysis. And the reason why is the standard of cover risk analysis forms the basis for almost all the decisions we make in terms of the service delivery that the public sees. The fire engines and ambulances going through the town on calls. It goes back to what I'm about to show you. First off, what exactly is accreditation? Well, it's a self-assessment process. It asks each agency who chooses to be involved in this to actually evaluate itself. It's an internal evaluation process. And with that, it's conducted through that, and it goes through looking at all the programs that we offer. Now, there are 10 categories that we have to look at, and of that, there's 240 points that we have to answer as part of that evaluation. It's very thorough. It's more thorough than just about anything that's out there today. It provides for peer review. That means that when the department is ready to be accredited, a team comes in. Some of you may remember when we've gone through this and we've had a team come in. It's usually 4 to 5 members of the fire service. They typically are senior officers with many years on the job, and they can use the criteria that's established through the process to evaluate the department and determine if it can be accredited. And more importantly, it's a management tool. The information that we develop out of this is something that we use on a daily basis. Now, the components of accreditation, first off, the strategic plan. We have an internal strategic plan for the department. We have the city strategic plan, but the department has one also. That folds into the city plan. And we have presented to the council over the years, and we refresh it every year. We do a department-wide meeting at it. Usually it's about every 3 to 4 years we meet with the staff and we bring it up to date. And the next part of that is the self-assessment manual. That's where we actually document our evaluation of the department itself. And the third component is the standard of cover and risk analysis. These three documents together are what are evaluated by the peer assessors when they come into an agency to inspect you. Now, the standard of cover, let's talk about that because that's what we're here for tonight. It's an assessment of fire and non-fire risk in community. Keep in mind that when we say fire department is our title, we do EMS, we do hazardous materials, we do technical rescue. We do a wide array of services for the community, but those are four that I can just right off the top of my head. So we look at fire and non-fire risk. We define what our baseline and benchmark response standards are. Baseline is what is the low end, benchmark is where we want to be. And then evaluates workload and utilization resources. That means how big is the call load and how do we use the available resources that we have to meet that call load. Then it measures how well we do that, and then it supports our strategic plan and policy development. It all goes funnels down into that. One of the first things that you do when you put this together is you have to evaluate the risk in your community, the risk that we have in Geneva. And to do that, we, at the beginning of our process of accreditation, we went out and touched every commercial and industrial and institutional building in the city. We evaluated its size, its use, its type of construction, its location, available water supply. All those go into that consideration. And when we did that, this is the table that comes up. And it's color-coded. The largest group that we have is low risk, which is defined as something that it happens more frequently, but if it does, it doesn't tax our resources. And so in there, you can see it's typically single-family homes, sometimes apartments, and we have about 7,200 units here in the city. And these stats are current as of the end of last year. The next highest one is a moderate risk. That's typically business. And there we have about 480 occupancies. And then the higher risk, which is you see is orange on the screen, is about 300. And then maximum, there are only three maximum risks here in the city. And they are the Houk Mifflin Book Depository, the Home Depot, which is essentially a lumber yard inside of a building, and the Union Pacific Railroad tracks. We used to have the King County Jail in our territory, and that was considered a high risk because we had over 400 inmates who were in a confined area that could not readily evacuate. Well, that since has moved out of the community, so that's why we're down to three. This looks great here in color, but it's all numbers. What does it look like when you put it on a map? It looks like this. This is the same data that's now depicted using our GIS capabilities to identify in a snapshot what that data looks like. And it doesn't show up too well here. I'll get you a smaller picture in a second. But it looks at the entire community, and you can see that the high hazard is out on the east side and a little bit more on the west side along Randall Road, where then we also have a moderate hazard, which is business. This is we're zeroing in now on the downtown business area. This shows you the outlines you see are the footprints of the buildings. And that identifies the risk that we see in those buildings based, again, on the type of construction, what their use is, their location, how close they are to each other. All those elements go into it. Now, one of the things that we've done with this is we've divided the city into six fire management zones. It's not very complicated. We deliberately kept it simple for ease of administration over the years. But the six fire management zones, of those, the largest one, or the ones with the most buildings in it, is zone number two, and I'll show you this to you a little bit better in a few slides here. But there's about 2,300 residential units, there's 338 commercial, and there's 68 industrial buildings in that zone. The next highest one is zone three, which is about 1,700 built houses, about 180 commercial units. And then there's zone five with 1,270 houses in it, and 51 commercial units. Now, what does that look like in a map? It looks like this. This is our fire management zone map, and what you see here, and the zones are numbered 1, 2, 3 across the top, reading left to right, and then it's 4, 5, and 6, reading left to right on the lower level. the areas that have the largest concentration of residents are 2, which is right in the middle, 3, which would be the east side, north of State Street, actually north of Union Pacific Railroad tracks, and then Zone 5, which would be roughly Eagerbrook down to the river. So once you have, and this is a, again, here's an enlargement, this is Zone 2. We showed you in detail. You can see where commercial forms in the business area, and then the rest of it is residential. Now, we've looked at that, and we've looked at the property use, and we've looked at the zones, but how do the allowance match up with the property use that we have? Where is our biggest source of customers, so to speak? Well, these are the stats for 2008, and if you look at residential, which is highlighted now, we had a little over 1,160 calls in residential, about $58,000 in loss, and it constitutes just short of 44% of the demand for our services. And the next one right after that is stores and offices.
Now, are these fire calls or ambulance calls?
It's all service.
All service.
Yes. The other part that we look at is census tract. Where is our census? Where is our densest population? And in this area, this is breaking down by zones again. I don't have a pointer here, but Zone 2, which is in the center on the top, Zone 3, which is over to the right on the east side, and then Zone 5 again, right in the middle on the lower level. Now, this is 2000 census data, so it doesn't accurately reflect what Fisher Farms does. Affects that. When we get the 2010 census, we'll update that, and that will change the way this all looks. Now, when we have the statistics, we have the number of incidents. I just showed you that in the data. This is what it looks like when you start doing what we call concentration analysis. This looks at where the calls are happening in town and how frequently they're occurring. So the darker the color, the orange, more orange, or the red it gets, the greater number of calls. Now, you saw the census where the population centers were. We were in fire management zone 2, 3, and 5. But if you look at the incidents, they're centered around the downtown, along the East State Street corridor, and along Randall Road. So it's not always where the population is that where your demand is for calls. And that doesn't always match up to what the risk is. So all this has to be balanced out when we're looking at response objectives for the agency. Now, why do we look at this so high? Let's talk just about the fire side. We won't get into EMS and hazmat. Just on fire side, we know that we have there are certain time elements that have to occur from when a fire occurs in a building. The first one is the fire's got to be detected. It's either somebody in the building who sees it, somebody who's driving by, or what we prefer is that there's a fire alarm or an even better sprinkler system in there. After that, they have to report the fire. And then after that, it has to be dispatched. That's the yellow line at the bottom. And then we respond. At that point, we've used up anywhere from 5 to 9 minutes of available time of the fire. And you can see from the cone effect, the fire grows exponentially after about 6 minutes. So time and getting there is important to us. Now, I have to go back here. One of the things that we look at in terms of time and response time, and again, I can provide this to you if you want a hard copy of it. This looks at our response time analysis, and if this goes from midnight at the top line down to 11:59 p.m. on the bottom. And as the darker the square, the rectangle, the longer the time would be. And you can see our times are longer after midnight and before 5 a.m. We know that. And it has to do with turnout time and just the natural process of it. We're still meeting our response objectives, but we know that that's an issue for us. This analysis shows us where the heaviest call load is. And it's typically between generally 9 a.m. over to about 6 p.m. That's where we see our greatest call load. That's what this is telling you right here.
Mayor, can we ask a question, or do you want to wait to
the end? I prefer to wait to the end so we have a proper flow. No no pun intended, from the fire department, of course, in terms of water flow.
I got it.
Did you get that, Chief?
Yeah, I got
good.
Okay, and the next step is we know where the population is, we know where the calls are coming from, we know what the hazard is, we know how important it is for us to get to a call for a fire. And for EMS, the time frame is just the same. So a person who has stopped breathing and with no pulse has a 4 to 6 minute window of survivability. So we have the same different issues of time. The next step you have to do is, how long does it take us to do the task that we have on the scene when we get there? And that's what's called, this is a task analysis, and we did this. We actually ran simulations of this over the years, and these were the numbers of people we've determined we need to be able to handle the risk. So the first column on the right is called low hazard. That's what we would call single family dwelling. And we know we need 18 to 19 people there to effectively manage that issue. And then we go to moderate risk, that's 24, high hazard is 35, and worst hazard is 35 to 40, and actually it's more than that. But these are the bare numbers that we need to make that happen. Now, with only 10 on duty, how do you do that? Well, you do it with auto aid, mutual aid, and the planning and relationships we have with agencies around us. And finally, this is what we do on the individual calls. We call the initial responding force the effective response force, ERF for short. That's essentially saying the number of people I just showed you, 19, 24, how long does it take us to get there? This is an analysis of a structural fire we had in March. Yes, in March. We were able to get our effective response force on the scene in 6 minutes and 33 seconds for that call. And that was 18 people. Yeah, does it always go like that? No, this was very early in the morning. Traffic was low and the travel time was short. If the longer travel time, the harder it is for us to do that. But we look at this after every major incident. And we evaluate whether or not we're getting our people there, if they're being assigned appropriately, do we have the right safety measures in place. But this goes on after every call. So tonight, that's a very quick snapshot. I went through it fast. But it's to give you a sense of the amount of planning that goes into that fire truck going down the street with the section sirens on. Any question?
That was awesome.
Yeah.
Very, very well done. Mr. Pollack, Mr. Dantino, Mr. Singer.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
When we were referring to the effective response force, your last slide indicated 6 minutes and 23 seconds. Does that have all of the people that are required on the scene?
Yeah, for that call, that was 18 people on the scene.
So it's from when everybody's there as opposed to when the first responders arrive.
Yeah, in that particular incident, the first unit was on the scene in 55 seconds. Yeah, and that doesn't happen for all calls. They happen for that particular incident.
And then you referenced earlier the response times are greater after midnight in the early morning hours simply because you've got to get...
People are getting out of bed.
And recognizing, too, that, and as we spoke earlier this evening, that traffic is getting worse. As a result, response times might be creeping up. Would it be in the best interest of the city to consider sprinklers, perhaps, for new construction as we go forward?
Residential sprinklers? It makes a difference. We have homes here in town that do have residential sprinkler systems. There aren't many, but there are. They are due to their size and location and how that was negotiated with the builder. Residential sprinklers are extraordinarily effective at controlling fires at very early stages. There's a lot of pushback from the construction industry of not wanting to do that. And there's always a, you probably know, if you're in the field, it's a push and pull all the time. We have tried to be very aggressive with sprinkler systems in commercial properties. We lowered the amount of square footage, and sometimes it's hard for the builders. But frankly, my own personal philosophy is if somebody pulls a project in our community, they have to take some amount of responsibility for protecting their investment. And part of that is putting into fire suppression and detection systems, because we can't provide all the people that would be needed to control something if that sprinkler system's not there. And so that's one of the reasons why we do that. I hope that helps.
Yeah, thank you.
Alderman Dantino.
Chief Olson, you said that on that fire that there was 18 to 19 people required, mm-hmm. and you only have like 10 at the station. The other 8 or 9 come from paid on call. Is that what happens, or where? How
well, those? In the initial response, we have auto aid agreements with Elburn, West Chicago, Batavia, and St. Charles, and between them, we get an engine and a truck and two engine companies, and that's what gets us to the 18. Then the paid on call, the off-duty people are coming back in, they're bringing in additional resources. Keep in mind, when they say that 18, that's the first attack. If it's a 96-degree day with 100% humidity, I guarantee you we're going to go through a lot more than 19 people, because best I'll have those firefighters is about 20 minutes. And then the heat exhaustion is going to take effect. We have to have more fresh people to come in and fix the place. So climate conditions affect it. So we need additional resources, but that's just the initial response that we're talking about.
Okay, thank you.
Alderman Singer.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Chief, did you equate false alarms into your categories? Okay. Now, there is an agency that evaluates the way you people perform your tasks, and based on your performances and equipments and whatever, they rate you. And is that correct?
I think you're referring to ISO.
Yes.
It's known as the Insurance Services Office. It's funded typically by the insurance companies, and it's geared towards determining how fast you can put out the fires that they insure and the properties that they insure. It does not look at hazardous materials, EMS, public education, to help make sure people have spent smoke detectors in their homes. It doesn't look at a variety of things that we do besides driving to the call, getting to the call. Just to show you the difference about ISO, ISO looks at a mile and a half radius from the station as the optimum location for the station. For those you aren't aware of it, that mile and a half comes from when horses used to pull the fire engine, and that's how far a horse could run at a dead run. That's how fast they could go. And times have changed. That's why we're accredited, and that's why we go through the accreditation process. It's a better process.
Okay, now, then there is a mode or method in which the insurance companies determine what the rates will be for a property owner's costs for their homeowner's insurance. And how was that equated in this?
ISO has a rating from 9 to 1, 9 being the worst rating and 1 being the best. We are a 3. We jumped from 5 to 3 and jumped in 2 classes, which is pretty unusual, but we did that over the last, 12 years. The schedule they use is called the Public Protection Class Rating Schedule. And when they come in, they look at water supply, communications, training, and equipment and suppression, the number of people you have on staff. And then from that, they develop a score of 1 to 9, and we're a 3. The trying to document the adjustment or the savings in your insurance rates, especially the homeowner, is difficult when you move just single ranks, primarily because most homeowners' insurance policy covers not just insurance, but theft and damage and liability, and it's a mixture of the process. So it's hard to pull that number out.
Mm-hmm.
If you jump from a 5 down to a 1, yeah, there's a big jump there, but there aren't many people in agencies that do that.
What would it take for us to move from a 3 to a 1?
Off the top of my head, we have to staff the truck company 24/7. That would be another 12 firefighters, probably out of third station. Those are 2 things off the top of my head.
Yeah,
3's good.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thank you, Chief.
You're welcome.
And we also have Alderman Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Given that the police are on patrol all the time, and many of your calls are EMS calls and traffic accidents, are they often the first ones there? I've seen a number of cases myself where the police were the first respondents to make it to an accident.
Do they have any
resuscitation abilities themselves?
We trained all the police officers in the use of AEDs, And then through an AED program that we were able to get a grant, and there's an AED in every squad car. They carry for basic first aid equipment. There's a lot that goes on at a car accident in those first few minutes, and the police officers are certainly willing to get their hand, get involved up to their elbows on anything that we ask them to. But they have their issues that they need to do, secure the area, make sure that everybody's safe, that we don't have anybody struck by a car while you're working on somebody, getting the people who are witnesses together. And they have so much to do that it's really hard for them to get intensely involved.
As soon as you get there, they take over the police duties and you take over your duties. But I was just wondering, if they happen to be there first, they do have some resuscitation ability.
Yeah, if they get into a cardiac arrest or something where it's called, they're certainly capable of doing that.
What fraction of your calls are actually EMS calls or traffic accidents? You respond to all traffic accidents, is that
no,
correct?
No, only ones with injuries.
Ah. No. So if you hear on the police radio or if you hear on the original call that it sounds like they're injuries on the 9/11 call, would you?
No, we don't monitor the first channel. TRICOM dispatches us. Mm-hmm. The dispatchers have the ability to make a unilateral decision that based on the type, the tone of the caller, mm-hmm. and the number of calls that they get, that this, we don't know their injuries, but we think you guys better go. They will dispatch us.
Okay.
But on average, it's when there are known injuries. Sometimes they wait till the officers get there and they determine, yes, there's injuries. Okay, now the fire department goes. And the ambulance, too.
But you say it can occur if the 911 call sounds enough that it's clear somebody's bleeding.
Yeah, the most seasoned dispatchers pick up on it remarkably often. They're not wrong often at all.
And I believe the police do the same thing with mutual aid, too, right? If there's a bad accident and there's a number of police have to show up, there is mutual aid from Batavia and St. Charles in terms of they cover each other as well as you cover with each other.
Sure. And the police use a frequency called iReach. And from that, all accidents, especially with injuries, are transmitted over iReach. And then that will send out a call to available officers respond. And then the first unit that gets there says, hold, either keep them coming in or hold them up. So the police do use that same strategy.
What happens to an accident that occurs? Let me pick Fabian, which is a high accident area and is a boundary between Batavia and Geneva. What do 9/11 do? Do they guess which should respond, or do they get both to respond? Or?
No, they. It's a bit of a science, and it's a bit of intuition.
So the TRICOM people have to...
They have to listen up. They say, where is it? What side of the intersection is it? What side of the road is it in? But to solve that, too, we've made the boundary such that the bridge is... But the Batavia Fire Department handles the bridge. We don't quibble over what side of the street it's on. Just take the whole bridge. And that makes it easier on the dispatchers. So we try to make their job a little easier. They have a tough job as it is.
I understand. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
You're welcome. Anyone else on the dais?
So, if it's on the bridge, it's painted. So,
pardon me?
If it's on the bridge, it's painted.
Yes.
Okay.
I have a quick question, Chief, if I may. You referenced the ERF report.
Right.
Who on the scene is responsible for collecting that data and presenting it to you?
All this data for response starts with the dispatch ticket that the dispatcher makes when they send us. They key it into the computer-aided dispatch system, or we call CAD. They put in the CAD. We have a connection out to TRICOM via the fiber optic system, and the CAD sends that data. There's the address, the occupancy name, and all the times involved with it. They send it to us, and it goes into our records management system. And then that goes into our database, and that's what forms. That's how we do analysis. That concentration map that you saw there with the orange, the yellow to orange, that's done by a separate program that looks at the data as it comes in and it analyzes it, and we can do those maps on a fly. We can look back at a week and see what that is. That program, that particular software program, also generates a report that's emailed to every officer in the department of any calls that exceed a six-minute response time in the previous 24-hour period. So if something goes over 6 minutes, we get a flag on it within 24 hours, and then go back and look at it, figure out what happened. All that happens to that fiber optic connection we have at TRICOM.
Interesting. And this is probably a softball question, but just for the fun of it, Mr. Pawlak commented that with increased traffic, there's a likelihood of increased response time.
Yes.
Is it your professional opinion that one of the reasons why there's increased response time is because knuckleheads don't pull over?
Well, I won't refer to them as knuckleheads, but people do not always fall over in front of us.
That's a technical term, Chief. I saw it in your annual report.
That's probably one of the most the thing in my over my career that I've noticed is that people just seem bound and determined to stay in our way. They either will stop right in front of us, they don't pull over, they pull in front of us. So we try to go around the left, they pull in front of us there. And it's really sort of, it's hazardous when we have those engines and ambulances going, lights and sirens. We're constantly reviewing that with our staff and how to respond. And we're always looking at our particular types of incidents and asking the question, do we really need to run lights and sirens with it? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is no, then we don't do it.
Lights and sirens tend to panic people, too. So they're not certain what the heck to do. Yeah, so if you don't need lights and sirens, you could probably get to a spot quicker than you could without the lights and sirens in some instances.
Sure. Yeah, it's
very, tripping the opticon and all, it's all good and glorious. And
If you're driving through downtown Geneva at 3 o'clock in the morning, as some of you may have from time to time, there's not any traffic there, so it's easy to make it through town. But you go down at 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, it's a different animal. Traffic definitely has an impact to us, and we have seen our response times lengthening over each year. They're getting out longer. So our response time, we were just talking this morning in the office that we may have to modify response time objectives because of the impact of traffic crimes, because we can't go faster.
Alderman D'Antino, then Flanagan.
Follow up on the mayor's question, since I'm a couple years past 16, what is the proper thing for us knuckleheads to do?
Move over to the right.
All the way right.
All the way to the right. If you're, even if it's coming toward you, you're supposed to pull over to the right.
Even if it's coming toward you?
Yes.
Because a lot of people stay in their center lane.
Right. Move over to the right. When you see lights, move to the right when you see the lights. That was a bumper sticker.
Slow down and stop if possible.
Yeah. Don't stop in the traffic lane you're in when we're coming up behind you. Get out of the way. And then they get upset when you get behind them and you have air horns, and suddenly the air horns finally get over the stereo system in the car. And it's quite shocking what happens.
In the opticon system, sometimes it goes on, and then when I see some out-of-town ambulances, they don't have a way to trigger that. It's just our internal. Why don't they have a general?
State law limits the use of opticon to police and fire agencies.
Not the ambulances.
On the privates, no.
Okay.
No. And all the fire departments that respond on a regular basis in us, they all have opticon emitters on there. An opticon emitter is a strobe light. You used to be able to see it very easily on our older vehicles, you can, but now it's up inside the light bar, so you can't see it as easily.
Thank you.
Not to make light, but actually Alderman D'Antino thought that we all got an opticon device in our cars becoming aldermen, but that's not true.
Pulling a mic.
Oh, you didn't get the memo?
I've already got one.
Do you?
Yeah. I've been on calls with Chief Holson.
He has.
Seriously?
And he's been on calls with me.
I was listening to your report, Chief.
Were you that far?
Yeah.
You weren't mayor at the time.
Awesome. Well, that makes sense. So apparently the school board officials get one. Does that make sense?
It's really iPads.
Just in case someone's grades drop below a B, you got to race to them. Alderman Flanagan.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. This is just kind of a curiosity. Do you just do both of the fire department stations go off at the same time, or do you pick and choose, or your west side, or how does
it's the city is broken up into two still districts. Still District 1 is Station 1, District 2 is Station 2, and they have their boundaries. Those are programmed into the CAD system, so when they type in the address or the intersection, the CAD system tells them who
determines which station to call.
Right. As an example, if it's Station 2 and they're due to go to the hospital for an activated fire alarm and they're already tied up, the CAD system will automatically recommend a replacement vehicle for that. So the dispatcher doesn't have to think about it or call us out on the field who to send. It's already built into the system.
Okay, so it is built in.
Oh, yeah. It's very structured in how it goes. So.
Thank you.
And I want to, just in a conclusion, if any of you would like to see what I just showed you on the screen in hard copy or face, don't hesitate to give me a call, and I'll be glad to get together with you and walk you through this stuff.
Well, Chief, you're going to make me sleep very soundly this evening.
Well, thank you.
Your address is not on the CAD system, Ron.
No, it's not.
And how many kids visit the fire department annually? How many tours do you provide?
I think the last time we looked at that, off the top of my head, I think we were about 1,200.
No kidding.
1,000 to 1,200 kids. We get quite a few through the fall and the spring. And then we do risk watch, and there's a threat. We get, I think that's up to, I don't remember how many we have with risk watch. I don't remember off the top of my head.
So you're saying you don't like children, is what you're saying, Chief?
I love them. Got three at home. So.
Anything else for the Chief? Anyone from the audience? This is really for the benefit of everybody. And your presentation was excellent.
It certainly was.
Really was.
And we can get reports to a blue in the face, but until you hear it from the guy in charge, or the lady in charge, as it were, it really makes sense. And I guarantee you, Chief, there's people watching, there's people who will watch this throughout the week who will say, gosh, I didn't know that. That's fascinating. It really is.
That's what I try to do, is just something where people may not realize just how much work goes into what we do.
Thank you, Chief.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good job, Steve.
I thought you were going to walk directly out the door, Chief.
Can't get a drink straight out.
Yeah. We're still alive.
Item 4, amendments to the agenda. Are there any amendments tonight, folks? Item 5 is the omnibus agenda. All items marked with an asterisk are considered to be routine and can be enacted by one motion.
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Singer, seconded by Piper. Mr. Clerk, please take the roll.
Don Vogelsberg.
Aye.
Chuck Brown.
Aye.
Ralph Dantino.
Aye.
Dorothy Flanagan.
Aye.
Sam Hill.
Aye.
Craig Maladra.
Aye.
Richard Marks.
Aye.
Ray Pollack.
Aye.
Robert Piper.
Aye.
Ron Singer.
Aye.
We jump down to item number 9A.
No.
No?
I guess the bills for payment, right?
Yeah. 9A.
9A, folks.
9A.
Correct. Yeah.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay.
Let the record show that Mr. Piper was incorrect in trying to correct the mayor.
Again.
9A, consider approval of use of city-owned parking lot on Hamilton Street, west of the United Methodist Church, on June 4th, 2009.
Otherwise known as Thursday.
Otherwise known as Thursday, yes, exactly.
Second.
The motion was Vogelsberg, seconded by Marks. And just for clarification, that purpose is for Ms. McKittrick.
Barbecue.
Ms. DeVita.
Fundraiser. Drive-through barbecue.
Ms. DeVita, please rise and speak to the podium. A drive-through barbecue? This is Ellen DeVita.
I made the motion.
Has this been involved in the CAD system of the fire department in case all, you know, what breaks loose at the barbecue?
They're having a barbecue, pick it up, it's all boxed, and you just come in one side of the lot and out the other, and they'll be at the church door handing them out, and it's to fund a mission trip.
Awesome. I think this is the mission trip that's taking place in about a week or so, correct?
That I do not know.
I believe this might be the mission trip to Lithuania.
Yeah, I think Mr. Brown's correct.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Very interesting trip.
Yes, I've had good talks with Kelly Nowak about it.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Anyone who has a guitar they would like to get rid of, they're
taking
guitars.
That's right. That's right, they are.
Well, they're going to buy them locally to stimulate the economy there.
I think if you had a good guitar that needed a
they
good
would take
home,
it.
They could
yeah.
find it for you.
They're going to be on the outlook for us for goods and merchandise produced there that possibly some of our businesses would wish to sell to get some import-export activity and maybe help stimulate their economy. They're going to a very depressed area. And the town is surprisingly, it's Torge, Lithuania, and it's surprisingly similar to Geneva in terms of it's on a river, 25,000 population, a lot of children and women living alone. The men have left for work. And
yes, Lithuania is very close to a failed state. When the Russians left, they left very little behind in the way of industry. And it's and as you say, most of the men have left the country in order to find work elsewhere in the Euro area. So it sounds like a very important mission for these people, and I will certainly support it.
There was a delegation from Torge who attended a brief ceremony about a month or so ago at the church, and I had the pleasure of meeting
them.
A couple, and we are sending a city flag and some tchotchkes, if you will, with certain missionaries to present to the people Chachki's international term for goodies that are produced in China.
And they're creating a documentary, a film
yes.
on this.
And there'll be a letter exchange between the mayors and all that good stuff. So,
sorry, Mayor, I thought you said Klotchkes.
Wrong country.
That's right, that's
close.
Anyone else? We have a motion and a second. This is great. And be sure to order your barbecue, right? All in favor of the request, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Item 10, municipal bills for payment. Mr. Clerk, kindly read the bills to be paid.
Bills for payment total $551,752.65.
Mr. Mayor, I move that we approve and pay the bills as read.
Second. Motion by Brown to approve and pay the bills as read. Seconded by Mr. Hill. Any questions or comments?
I should add that those bills are displayed on the city website for anyone who's interested in the detail.
They will be once they are approved. That's correct.
Yep. They already are.
We just anticipated a blessing. Mr. Clerk, please take the roll.
Don Vogelsberg?
Aye.
Chuck Brown?
Aye.
Ralph Dantino?
Aye.
Dorothy Flanagan?
Aye.
Sam Hill?
Aye.
Greg Mahadra?
Aye.
Richard Marks?
Aye.
Ray Pollock?
Aye.
Robert Piper?
Aye.
Ron Singer?
Aye.
Item 11A is to consider professional engineering services agreement with Stanley Consultants in the amount not to exceed $151,490 for electric upgrades for portions of Western Avenue, South Street, and Kesslinger Road.
So moved.
Second.
Brown motions and Hill seconds. Mr. Buffington is with us again tonight. Mike, welcome back. He's joined by Mr. Dingus and Mr. Hal Wright. We had some substantive discussion regarding this item last week, and I'm curious if anyone has any additional comments and or questions for Mr. Buffington. Mr. Paul.
I don't have any questions for Mike.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. My fault.
Okay.
Mary was just reminding me that there is a breakdown of all the items in the packet as we requested from Mr. Buffington. So.
I don't have any questions for Mike, but wanted to thank him for providing that information to us. I did vote against this last week. I understand that statutorily that we are not precluded from bidding this. But in these tough economic times, when we're reducing employees' hours and salary, I feel we have a fiduciary responsibility to the citizens of Geneva and the employees to save money where we can. And by competitively bidding this project is, I feel, the best way. Now, I understand that Stanley has worked for the city in the past, and if we were to bid this out, and with their knowledge base, perhaps their bid would be the lesser of those bids. But as I stated when I, last week, I feel we should bid this out. Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else on the dais? We have a motion by Brown, a second by Hill. Mr. Clerk, please take the roll call.
Don Vogelsberg?
Aye.
Chuck Brown?
Aye.
Ralph Dantino?
Nay.
Dorothy Flanagan?
Aye.
Sam Hill?
Aye.
Greg Mahadra?
Aye.
Richard Marks?
Nay.
Ray Pollock?
Nay.
Robert Piper?
Aye.
Ron Singer?
Aye.
Motion passes 7-3. According to my notes, we are at item 14, folks, new business. New business from the dais, Alderman Singer, then Alderman Flanagan.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. For those citizens of Geneva that are looking in this evening, on June 6, 2009, the First Division Museum will hold a special observation of the 65th anniversary of D-Day at Cantigny Park in Wheaton, Illinois. The centerpiece of the day's activities will be the unveiling of a newly acquired LCVP, which is a Landcraft vehicle and personnel. It's an original 1943 landing craft that was founded in Normandy and has been completely restored by the North Carolina Maritime Museum. I hope that the people that are watching this evening and our friends here on the council would like to join a great number of individuals, hopefully a great number of veterans that were engaged in that invasion are being invited. I was not in that conflict at the time, but I am going to be attending, taking a colleague of mine who was a dear friend who was involved in that period of time, and hopefully we're going to find it to be very entertaining and historical. So those of you that are watching and those of you that are present this evening, certainly you're being invited. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Singer. Alderman Flanagan.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Actually, this is a recognition and a thank you to the high school horticultural class. Tom Anderson and his group, before they left this year's class, or this year's school year, have planted and they grew the flower in the flower boxes on the bridge. Not the hanging baskets, but those particular flower baskets, boxes. And so they grew them, they planted them, and they placed them on the bridge. And I want to thank Tom Anderson for his dedication to that project. He says he's going to grow more flowers because he put some additional ones on 31 and 3rd, too. So next year we're going to be blessed with more flowers that they've grown for us. And a special thank you to Marv Hosman. He was the one who orchestrated that with our group. And we're looking forward to many years of them providing us additional flowers, which will really help us. So thank you again to him.
Thank you. Anyone from the audience?
Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Brown, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Just wanted to say kudos to Mr. Dan Dinges and his department. There was a lot of trees down in those storms we had last night. There was one completely blocking Anderson Boulevard, and by the time I got there on my way to work, the crew had already cleaned it up and traffic was on its way. So I think you must have had a lot of calls early this morning. Did you, Mr. Dinges?
I knew. I had it done.
Wonderful, wonderful. You did a wonderful job. Please convey our thanks to the crews that were out there working in the storm. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
There wasn't a microburst last night, was there? I mean,
oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Something hit. Man.
You cranked out a few.
Through the first ward, there were a number of trees down. It must have been a whole line of little microbursts came through.
Here in Dryden. Anyone from the audience, any new business? I just want to read a couple important announcements. Mary McKittrick regularly provides me with a list of those who are celebrating anniversaries in the month of June. And I'll rattle off a few of them that are close to this date. But the young lady to my right, Stephanie Dawkins, tomorrow she will have been with us for 1 year. Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
Congratulations.
Who thought it felt longer, anybody?
Just two of you.
Except for you, Stephanie. But, you know, oftentimes when we celebrate the chief's service to the community, we sometimes forget how many people have served how many years, which I think is testimony to how the operations of the department heads and everybody else works here in town. For example, at the police department, there's a young lady serving 12 years, Diana Gobin. Keith Koza, whom we all know, 27 years. Beth Nelson at the police department, 28 years.
Jeez.
Ron Chapman, the electric department, 16. Jeff Price, our buddy in the sewer department, 20 years. Of course, Chief Olson, 30. Our favorite, or I should say one of our favorite detectives, Frangella, 10 years. Isn't that amazing? Chad Clark, the tallest, biggest guy in the fire department, 13 years. Brian Meduzia. Who knows where Brian Meduzia works?
Mary.
Well, no. Who on the council knows? He's one of our fine officers, 11 years. So I'll rattle off more names at the next meeting as well. But there's a lot of folks who obviously contribute their time and talent virtually in anonymity. And it's nice that we recognize them every now and then. So, Stephanie, congratulations on one full year.
Thanks. Maybe I can make it third.
All depends how closed session goes. We'll see. If there's nothing else, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn to closed session.
Don't move.
On possible purchase of real property for the use of the public body. Motion by Singer.
Second.
Seconded by Hill. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Great. Microphones are off. There's no action being taken tonight. Help.
No.